This morning, we will record the second of a series of interviews with President Emeritus Frederick L. Hovde in his office in the Executive Building, Purdue University. This is recorded on May the 18th, an interview between R.B. Eccles Department of History and Mr. Hovde. This is a record made for the use of the Purdue University archives and is the second of a series. The last time we were chatting, we were talking about your coming to Brasenose College, Oxford, and your Oxford career. We just got started. Supposing we take up there this morning.
Bob, there may be a few things that we should review about the first day's taping.
Very good.
For instance, you wanted to know about my teachers at Minnesota who were influential, and I don't believe we talked about that.
We talked only about one or two.
Well, we talked about Professor G.B. Heisig, who taught general chemistry. But there were other teachers that... I liked and became friendly with. I think of famous professor of chemistry at Minnesota, Miss Lillian Cohen, who was a great lady in every respect, and everyone who studied chemistry or chemical engineering knew Miss Cohen. Her office was always open. Students enjoyed talking with her. One of my freshmen English teachers was a very stimulating man. A man by the name of Ralph Bennett. Professor of Organic Chemistry, whom we all knew and loved at Minnesota, was Professor Hunter. Then, of course, the head of chemical engineering, Dr. Charles Mann, was a fabulous character and individualist and stimulator of students.
Didn't one of your professors go to Iowa later? I remember in 1948, I guess it was, I met this gentleman, I forget his name, at Iowa, who said he had taught you. And
yes, one of the staff at Minnesota went to Iowa in chemistry. Name slips me for the moment.
Did you do your foreign languages at Minnesota?
Only German. German is required of the students taking degrees in chemistry or chemical engineering. One of the famous professors at Minnesota, a well-known man, Professor Jim Davies, taught German. And I was one of his students. He, Professor Jim Davies, delighted in singling me out in class. I had other priorities with respect to my time and didn't study my German very much. And I think I got the lowest grades I got in the university in
German.
But Doc Spears, who was the football coach during the entire time I was in Minnesota, was of course a very interesting man and teacher and a friend of mine. And after I'd won the Rhodes Scholarship, or been selected for the Rhodes Scholarship, Doc Spears was lunching with Jim Davies at the faculty club, so the story goes. Jim Davies said to Doc Spears that he didn't think Fred Hebby deserved the Rhodes Scholarship. Doc Spears looked at him and said, "Well, you know, Jim, there's a lot of difference between an umlaut and a chemical formula."
That's wonderful.
Which I always thought was an amusing story. Trying to think of the name of the professor of quantitative analysis who was one of the toughest taskmasters we had as instructors. Well, oh, Professor Geiger. Yes. While we were students in quantitative analysis, which is a very rough, tough course, both in the lab and in the classwork and problem solving required, none of us particularly loved Professor Geiger. But after it was all over, after you got through, and subsequently we're looking back on the teachers that were good, Geiger always rated at the top of the list, because you felt that while his wasn't a personality to be loved, if you survived the experience, you had something. Well, a man doesn't have many great teachers in his lifetime. No man does. I suppose there are about as many great teachers in the world as there are great of anything else.
I would
imagine
so. Doctors,
lawyers, statesmen,
yeah.
Philosophers, artists, and they're rare breeds, all of them. Gifted people. And the numbers of gifted people in the world is not very great. And yet almost all world progress, advancement, stems back to these very people.
Correct.
But I had my share, and generally I liked my teachers as people. I can't remember a single one that I disliked. I had no reason to dislike any of them. And of course there's a lot of nonsense talked about good, bad, and bad teaching. Most students elect to study a subject or a group of subjects or a discipline because they're interested in the discipline. They're not interested in who teaches it. And what your interest really is in the subject matter of the discipline or the course you're taking, and that interest is almost independent, because students will study history or government or mathematics in every college and university in the land. And the fact that they go to a particular institution means that they're going to get somebody to teach these courses, and their interest in that subject matter is almost independent of their future teachers. Well, it is independent of their future teachers.
I don't know whether I'm a good teacher or not, but I know that when I came here, one of the first challenges I had was from those engineers who said, "Look, we want to get through quickly. To take history is a detour in our education. We don't like it. We don't want it. Now we have to have it." And you know, it was a challenge. I
don't know whether I ever met it or not, but it was really something. Because it's rather startled me to find people in class who weren't there because they wanted to know some history.
Right.
It did me good.
Well, the Oxford experience was a fantastic phase of my life and development. Perhaps the most fascinating time in my younger life, certainly the most fascinating time in the whole period of my formal educational schooling. I remember leaving home in North Dakota, September, drive to Minneapolis with my family in a Model T Ford. In the morning we left, I and my high school pal Joe O'Brien. Hunting season had just opened. And we went out duck hunting. 4 in the morning. Did our shoot at dawn in the slough north of town. You know, the little lakes formed by the melting snow and the farmland called sloughs.
Mm-hmm.
The dawn flight, we shot our 15 ducks apiece and came back to town. The family. We left for the long drive from Minneapolis. Trained in New York City. The night before the boat sailed, all the Rhodes Scholars were given a dinner party on board the boat. Our boat was the Aquitania, the old Aquitania. Sister ship of the Mauritania and the Lusitania. The Canard people gave this dinner. The class, I suppose 25 of us were in the group of 32 that year. Others had gone to England earlier or were going by other ways, but about 25 of us, and many of the old ex-Rhodes Scholars in New York City came to the dinner. The Student Committee on Arrangements for Travel was headed by a Yale Rhodes Scholar by the name of Malcolm McIntyre. And there was after dinner speeches. McIntyre spoke for our class. And when he spoke, my first reaction to this man was that he was an insufferable Ivy League prig. Well, first judgments it taught me a valuable lesson that you never make first judgments about people or quick judgments. When the boat sailed the next day, all of us began to get acquainted. We found that 3 of us in the group were going to Brazenose. One was Malcolm McIntyre, and the other was Armistead Booth of Virginia, and myself. I soon discovered that my first judgment of Mr. McIntyre was completely wrong, because it turned out in many respects that he was the most capable man of our entire class. and a great individual. We became great friends and even roomed together for 2 years at Oxford.
That was in college or in Diggs?
Well, in college we shared rooms for the second year and then in Diggs the third year. He was a remarkable man in that he supported and worked his way through Yale, scholarship and so on, summer work. While he did it, he also supported his mother. He was Phi Beta Kappa. He was an All-American lacrosse player, captain of the Yale lacrosse team. Fine athlete. Fine mind. But that's an aside, really. For a country boy from the Dakota Plains and the University of Minnesota to be thrown into the life and environment of Oxford was a an experience of it was an experience initially eye-opening because all of us are conditioned by our environment to think and believe a stereotyped image of other people, and in this case the stereotyped image of the English stereotype. But what you found was that as you get to know them, understand them, become friends with them, talk with them, be invited by them into their circles, you found a rational explanation of, a rational understanding of why they're like they are and why we were like we are.
Very true.
You began to appreciate them as individuals and as members of a society, the English society, the English nation. College life, the academic life, of course, and the organization of the university were completely different. You were assigned your tutor. In my case, I had a very good tutor, distinguished British chemist, by the name of Thomas Weston Johns Taylor. He was an organic stereochemist, whose research and scholarly interests were in the configuration and structure of organic compounds. And of course you saw him once a week in his rooms in college. You wrote your essay for him. Beginning of term he would discuss with you the lectures that he thought you ought to go to and the laboratories that you ought to go to and do the experimental work, the inorganic and organic and physical chemistry labs. He was a sharp-minded, sharp-tongued tutor. Uh, no obvious emotional or mental prejudices against Americans. And I enjoyed the work with him. I remember the first tutorial, Professor Taylor, Dr. Taylor, was a chain cigarette smoker. On his desk he had a big box of English cigarettes, Players, Wills, I've forgotten. And in the first tutorial, so on, he was smoking. He didn't offer me a cigarette, so I pulled my own package of cigarettes out of my pocket, lit one up, and he looked at me coldly and said, "There will be no smoking. You will not smoke if you're in tutorials." And so for 2 years, I went once a week and watched him smoke. Well, I sat there and talked with him about chemistry. Much of the chemistry that was given in the lectures I attended and so on that first year was repetitious. I mean, I'd had it, and the laboratory work I'd had, and so on. So I can't say that the academic work was onerous. I had lots of time to do everything else.
Did you start out your first term to try out for the college rugger team?
Oh, yes. I wanted to play rugby, and my friend Mr. McIntyre, of course, wanted to play lacrosse because he'd been a star at Yale and captain of the Yale team. And Oxford and Cambridge both had lacrosse teams. Indeed, there were amateur lacrosse teams in the Midland areas of England that were as fine amateur teams as existed any place in the world. It was quite a popular sport, actually. But in the college, in Brasenose College, were a group of rugby players that were very good to me. And I started out by playing with the third team of the college, and getting instruction from two or three men. One particular friend was Bill Roberts, a Welshman, who was later captain of the Oxford team, and a fine standoff half. Another chap by the name of Taylor, who was helpful and friendly. Another first-year man with me by the name of C.A.L. Richards, Cal Richards, we called him, who later had a distinguished career in the British Colonial Service, mostly in Africa. He was a fine athlete and a good lad. He was helpful. And then, as I learned the game, I played in the second 15 and then finally in the first 15 that first year. The college had very good rugby, and we played 3 or 4 times a week in the fall and during much of the winter. Rugby season extends into the winter months, which aren't very rarely have snow, of course, in Oxford, so the fields are always available.
Might be a bit muddy at times, and you might come up with a face full of mud, but
the mud never hurt anybody.
No.
But I enjoyed getting dressed in our rooms and bicycling in your uniform to the various playing fields and playing rugby and then having tea or beer at the sports clubhouse of each college maintained on their own playing field grounds. Became acquainted with a wide number of players, men from other colleges. In fact, it was one of the easiest ways to become acquainted with a great many men. because you played against them in game and game and game and game of football, rugby football.
Did you go up to varsity your last, when did you go to varsity?
Well, I played for the varsity my third year.
Your third year.
I should have made the team my second year. Steve Hoffmeyer from South Africa was captain. I didn't understand the system very well, but I spent the summer taking American tourists around and then finished the summer off in August, September in Munich. Came back when term opened and I was invited to play in the senior trials. And it wasn't in good condition. I didn't play very well. A couple months later I was playing first class rugby, good enough to play for the varsity, but that was too late, the second year. So I said to myself, my third year, I'd come back in shape. That third year, Bill Roberts, my friend from Braden, I was a captain. And I played again on the senior trials. It's my second year in the winter, I played with the Greyhounds, the Oxford University organization that's composed of many of the varsity players and others who were the young coming players. I had the great fun of going on the Greyhound tour to Germany that second year, where I played wing three-quarter to a famous English rugby player, Oxford player, by the name of G.P.S. McPherson. G.P.S. McPherson was a Scot who had played on the famous Oxford rugby team with the Scottish three-quarter line. G.P.S. McPherson was the star of that particular Oxford team and was a famous player in England.
Did you ever get any bones broken from rugby?
No.
Dislocations?
I played high school football, Minnesota football, and rugby football, covering a span of 4, 8, 11 years, and I never was hurt. Oh, bruises, you know, sprains, but never hurt to the extent that I have any residual difficulties today. So in that respect,
you won your blue your senior year then.
That's right. I remember my third year. Oh, in November. Almost all the outstanding athletes at Oxford belonged to a club called Vincent's Club. McIntyre and I were members of the Vincent's Club. We were invited in our second year to become members. We enjoyed Vincent's Club because it had club rooms close by Brazen House on the High Street there.
Yeah.
And in the middle of November 1931, there was a notice posted on the Vincent's Club bulletin board, a sheet of notepaper. And I can remember the wording of it to this day. Well, prior to that, I received a letter from Bill Roberts. A very formal letter. Dear Abdi, would you please play for my team against Cambridge University at Twickenham on the afternoon of December 8th. Yours sincerely, Bill Roberts, captain. Well, you write a note back to him and say, my dear Bill, I would be delighted to play for your team against Cambridge at Twickenham on Saturday, December 8th.
But you did.
Yours, sincerely. There was a notice posted in the Vincent's Club bulletin board which said, read as follows. To the members of the OURFC, that's Oxford Rugby Football Club, inasmuch as the Cambridge game is only 3 weeks away, I suggest the chaps limit themselves to a modicum of beer per day, say not more than one pint with each meal, and smoke not less than 20 nor more than 40 cigarettes per day.
Per day.
Signed, Bill Roberts, captain. And that note, of course, set the training rules for varsity. A week before the varsity match, I was working in the lab, my research project, and I had an explosion. I was doing reactions and test little glass vessels at 200 degrees centigrade in an oil bath at that temperature. And one of these little vessels exploded, burned the entire back of my left hand. It was only a week before the Cambridge game, and I saw my chance to play go glimmering. And my tutor for my third year, H.W. Thompson of St. John's, a distinguished world-famous physical chemist today, rushed me to a doctor, and I told the doctor, I said, you've got to fix me up to play next week. He said, well, we'll try. My hand badly burned, entire back of it. He said, now, he dressed it. He said, during the night, blisters will form. You come in early in the morning. The next morning, sure enough, the hand was a mass of blisters. Went into his office and he cut off all the blisters, leaving nothing but the raw skin.
Oh, dear.
And he put my hand in a basin filled with a solution of mercuric chloride. Well, that hurt worse than the burn. Then he bandaged it and said, come in tomorrow. The next day, there were more blisters. And he cut those off and did the same thing. He did that for 3 days. And then he doused the hand, as I remember it, with lanolin, bandaged it up, started to heal very quickly. And all the blisters and the healing process, the skin was tender, was okay within a week's time, and there was no scar.
Remarkable. I've never heard of that particular way to handle it.
So I was able to play. Of course, we won the game, and a very exciting game at Twickenham, 10-3. And that was a great thrill. We had a remarkable rugby team. There were 5 Rhodes Scholars on it.
From South Africa, Germany, America,
2 from
Canada.
New Zealand, 1 from Australia, 1 from South Africa, and myself. They were all remarkable men, fine athletes.
Were the German scholars there at that time?
The German scholars had just started about 1928 or 29.
Coming back.
There were 2 or 4 or 6 German scholars my last year. I met and knew one of them vaguely. His name I can't remember now. But there were none in Brasenose. They were in other colleges. If there'd been some in Brasenose, I
might have known them, of course.
Some of those early Rhodes Scholars were involved in the plot, one of the plots to assassinate Hitler during World War II.
Commendable but dangerous.
In the spring, I was after the actual track team and ran the dashes and the relays. And I was the only pole vaulter, I guess, at Oxford, and I wasn't a, I didn't fancy pole vaulting. I'd done some in high school. And I could do 10-6. That was good enough to be first ranked for Oxford in those days. I know anybody that could do 11-6 was good in the 20s. The world record, I guess, was less than 14 feet at that time. But I enjoyed running the relays and the dashes for Oxford. One of my teammates was Jerry Lovelock, the New Zealander, who placed in the Olympic 1500 meters. I think he ran the Olympic 1500 meter in Los Angeles in 1932. The Olympics in Los Angeles in 1932. Cambridge beat us at track. They had some fine track. Yeah. In particular, one outstanding star of Emma Tyndall. A fine British athlete track. Show you how small the world is. The other day we had the Grissom Chaffee lectures at luncheon. Sat across from Athelstan Spillhouse. Spillhouse was a South African boy. Mm-hmm. Came to this country to study after Cape Town University. We got to talking about South Africans that we both knew. It turned out that Benny Osler, South African Rhodes Scholar, replaced who was next to me on the Oxford team. I played wing three-quarter, and Benny was center three-quarter. Was Spillhouse's best friend when they were students in Cape Town. And I had never known this.
It is a small world, isn't it?
We played the 1931, the Springboks, the South African national team, captained by Benny Osler. Stanley's brother, older brother, came to play a 15-game series in England against all the leading clubs. And I think they were undefeated in England. They played at Oxford. We thought we had the finest amateur football team in England that year. And we played the Springboks even for the first half. And shortly before the first half arrived, we lost two of our players to severe injuries. And we played the Springboks the entire second half with only 15 men against their 15. And that meant that we had to take two men out of the scrum and put them in the back line.
Back line.
The scrum couldn't handle the powerful South African scrum, and they dominated the ball game in the second half. But if we'd remained at full strength, I feel sure we would have beaten them. Because they weren't, the game was even the first half.
They weren't that fast.
What?
They weren't that fast.
They beat us in the second half, but it was a close game even so. They didn't overpower us in the second half.
Did you score on them?
Oh, yes.
Good.
We scored them. I forgot what the score was now. 24-14 or something like that at the end. But we hadn't lost two men. We would have given them the toughest game in England. That was fun. Of course, wherever you play, I played in England, Ireland, rugby, Scotland, Germany, and France. You were the guests of the home team and club. And after you played your match, you were always entertained with a dinner that night. And your host club members would take you out and show you the town. It was a hilarious, fun, social time.
I didn't know the Irish played rugby. Do they play a lot of rugby or just...
Oh, sure. We played in Dublin against the Dublin Wanderers. A big stadium in Dublin. And they were tough. I was playing for the Oxford team then. In Dublin. There's the spring tour of the Oxford varsity was always fun. In spring.
You did that during spring vacation?
In spring vacation, the team would go to play in France. And the year I went to the varsity in spring vacation, on a tour, I went to Pau, Bordeaux, and Biarritz to play. The Côte d'Azur, the western coast of France. In all the years I'd go to Côte d'Azur, Pau, Bordeaux, and Biarritz, and then the other, next year they'd go to the Riviera. We also played in Paris. Now that was a fun trip.
These were always against French teams?
Always against French teams. Not university, but clubs.
French clubs, yeah.
And on the French club, you'd have a whole cross-section of Frenchmen, ranging from French gentlemen to tough truck drivers, laborers, God knows what. And some of the games against the French were pretty rough, pretty dirty.
They don't quite have Marquess of Queensbury rules in some cases.
That's French, but all the rugby I played in England, I never had occasion, I never saw anything I would call muckerism.
Just dirty play.
Dirty play.
Rough, yes. Tough, yes.
Rough and tough, yes, but never dirty.
Yeah.
Playing against one of the French teams, I was tackled and out of bounds. Instead of stopping the tackles, the two Frenchmen just kept on with their tackles and drove me into a fence completely unnecessarily. Made me so angry, I got up and took a punch at one of these Frenchmen. This was unheard of. I think I received more censure from my teammates for this unseemly, unsporting act of fighting and hitting an opponent. More censure from my teammates than I did from the Frenchmen.
I trusted they respected you, however, for it.
Well, memories are vague of what happened, except I remember the incident and how angry I was. But
did you find
what I called unnecessary roughness?
Do you find that the continental sense of sportsmanship is much like the English, or is it more in the sense of... I never found it to be so.
Continentals are not brought up with
the sense of sport.
In the same code.
Right.
Code of conduct that the Englishman has.
Chivalry, perhaps, or yes, but not the sportsman of the...
Well, I don't have this code, the amateur gentleman's code, that pervades the English amateur sports, and even pervades the professional sports in England.
Do we have it here, you think?
We have it more than the continental, but less than the British. So I like that aspect of it very much. The social life, the intellectual life at Oxford, of course, had many facets.
Did you belong to any of the college science clubs, you know, where you go read papers to each other?
Yes, there are several such clubs in college. One I liked particularly was a club which met every 2 weeks or so and read plays. You were assigned a part. The secretary got the books. Everybody was assigned a part and go through a play. I used to go to the Union, the Oxford Union, especially on those nights when there was something interesting. Although I wasn't a keen devotee of the Oxford Union, I participated in English debating.
Did you debate at college?
No, no, I don't know, so.
No, I mean at Oxford.
No.
My first debate at Oxford was the usual one. We regret this house supports a proposition that the rock should have landed on the pilgrims instead of vice versa.
Yeah, all the big topics had a humorous aspect. Yeah. Of course, they were good at the light touch of debate, and humor, of course, got more votes than solid reasoning. They didn't take their debating as seriously as we do.
Entirely different style.
Entirely different style. Our great people came to lecture in science fields. I remember hearing Einstein. He started off his lecture in German by asking the audience to forgive him for giving his lecture in German. But if he gave it in English, they would understand less than if he gave it in German. Which I thought was a kind of a humorous way to start.
Did you spend all of your vacations, excuse me, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Well, vacation time, of course, was the time for exploration of the continent. And the first vacation, of course, we wanted the first week in London and the first week in London and the week in Paris. McIntyre and I, by that time, had become friends. So we did London for a week as soon as term ended. And of course, London was a fabulous city. And we explored Paris for a week. Then we went to a town in the Austrian Tyrol called Zeppel to ski. And we were there a month. We were the only two English-speaking people in the village, two young men. We had a fabulous time there. We'd study and read in the morning, have lunch, ski all afternoon, have late tea. And there was a German girl in the house next door who would come and have tea with us and teach us German. She was pretty competent in English. And we spent the evenings in the village at the Bierstubes. It was a delightful month. We had a great ski instructor. And well over 50, and to this day, Carl Jenewein. He and five brothers, he had lost four brothers in World War I, in the Austrian Army. And he was an interesting man and a master skier. He was in the Alpine troops of the Austrian Army.
Jäger Corps.
Whatever they called it. But he liked us because we took the skiing like ducks to water. All the rest of his pupils were either little kids or elderly Germans, ranging all the way up to grandfathers and grandmothers. And before we were returned to Oxford, he said he wanted to take us on a trip. We got on the electric line that morning about 4 o'clock, went down through Innsbruck and up into the mountains between Innsbruck and Italy. 8 o'clock, we got off the train on the side of a mountain, a little tiny stopping place for the train. From 8 to 1, without stopping, we climbed to the top of one of the mountains there. When we got to the top, we were above the clouds. You could see for hundreds of miles in all directions. Wind was blowing. We got down on the lee side of the peak. Had some lunch we carried with us. Then the instructor, Jenevine, strapped on his skis. Went up over the top, started down the snowfields. Two neophytes following us. We climbed the mountain from one side. We came down and all the way around the mountain, back
on the
to
other.
Where we started. And halfway down, we stopped the farm family on the side of the mountain. The rightful family who knew Jenevine. They served us hot chocolate, Christmas cake, and they had the great tile eating unit in the living room. In the back part of the house, they had the animals, the cows. They stopped there for coffee and cake and chat with these people and on there down. Came back to where we started. And it was just darkness had fallen when we got there. Pretty soon the train came along. I got on the train. Got back to Zeefeld late that night, about midnight, after a fascinating experience. I think McIntyre and I fell at least 100 times going down that mountain.
He didn't do it once, of course.
Oh, no. I went the whole way without ever falling, or even coming close to it. And next morning, we got on the train and started a long trip back to Oxford.
Did
then
you
each spring vacation, we'd pick a different country to go to. And in the summers, I worked taking tourists around as a tour conductor for the Franco-Belgique Travel Company. We'd meet a group of American Party of tourists at Southampton, take them over to Amsterdam, go down the Rhine, through Switzerland, Italy, back up to Paris.
Did you ever take that
take
walking?
Take the boat train and come back to London, take another group around the circuit.
Oh, fun. Did you ever take the walking trip to the Schwarzwald, Freiburg, and up to Titicaca?
Well, McIntyre and I and a professor from Yale, French professor that we know, and another young youngster from Yale, and I were did a walking tour through the mountains of Alsace, Lorraine, over the terrain where they fought parts of the Franco-Prussian War. Was 1870?
1870.
Yeah.
You end up at Verdun?
We didn't. We were near Verdun, but we didn't go into Verdun. We were up in the mountains and walking those trails.
Very interesting.
2 weeks to enjoy. We saw some of the fortifications, the remnants of the fortifications from World War I.
Your French and German had to be adequate then.
Well, I mean, adequate enough to fill your simple needs.
Sure.
McIntyre was a better linguist than I. He had gone to Boston Latin School and taken Latin in high school and 4 years of Latin at Yale. You have a solid basis of Latin to which on which to work. But he was an art student anyway. Never took law at Oxford. But he was a little better than I was at the languages. But you had enough to sort of get by, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Understand 50% of what was said to you.
Did you ever get mixed up in any historical, political, or, international matters, like Geneva, seeing the League of Nations in session, or anything of that nature?
No, never in Switzerland at that particular time. We used to spend, the end of the summer vacation at Belderfing on Sternberger See near Munich, on the electric line from Munich to Garmisch-Partenkirchen.
I've been over it.
And we were in Belderfing, we stayed in a fisherman's pension on the lake, beautiful lake. We had friends there, a German-American family by the name of Heinrich Bruning. Mrs. Bruning came from St. Paul, Minnesota. The Brunings had two very lovely daughters. Heinrich Bruning was a German who made a fortune in this country in the export trade, import trade, and then retired to this villa at Belderfing with his American wife, these two girls. The Bruning family were nice to McIntyre and me. And we met their friends around before. There was one family, von Puschinger. Mrs. von Puschinger was a Boston lady. Their son, when we met, was a member of a crazy outfit in Munich called the Brown Shirts. And their son was one of the young kids that had gotten started with Hitler in Munich. And the family couldn't understand this boy. Of course, the boy was involved in something at that time which they couldn't understand and which of course no one could foresee would develop into
the Nazi party.
Hitler push and the Nazi party and so on. I don't know whatever happened to this boy, von Puschinger, but his mother was a Boston Brahmin. I remember meeting a young man, families discussing the German organization in Munich, the Brown Shirts, as they were called. I wore these brown shirts.
I became acquainted with them in Berlin in 1933.
Well, we were there in 30 and 31.
Yeah. Just getting started. And the Depression was on. People were out of work. It was a hard time.
Were you? Well, life in Bavaria was pleasant. The Bavarian people were always very pleasant. Any group of people would always greet you during the day with the pass. Grüß Gott.
Grüß Gott.
Well, yeah, it can't be too bad.
You see, I never got that. In Berlin, I was there during the revolution, so it was always Heil Hitler. Once in a while, if we'd say Guten Tag, but it was usually Heil Hitler who came in and left. That was, of course, after the immediate success of Hitler. Oh, dear.
Well, the thing that was most interesting to us, general discussions around actual nuclear, it was the great communist experiment in Russia.
Mm-hmm. Did you find the Oxford, you were there right after it, did they talk a great deal about the general strike, and did they talk much about the Labor Party and the socialists taking over?
In that time, Ramsay MacDonald had been was prime minister. The great strike had occurred,
1926, yes.
And 3 years later, I'd forgotten all about it.
Mm-hmm. I imagine.
The Depression years in England antedated ours.
Oh, yes.
And they were beginning to come back by 1930. The Labour Party was pretty strong at that time.
Remember
and the students were pretty evenly divided. Labour and Conservative Party, and some liberal. The famous old liberal Lloyd George was still alive.
Oh, yes.
I've forgotten what year he died. But
died about 47.
Is that right?
Yeah.
But he was still alive.
Oh, yes.
But not.
Did you see any of the
Asquith
family?
No political following.
Did you see any of the Asquith family? They
well, have, it was a name. I don't know.
I just wondered if you. And did you go punting on the Charwell and on the river?
Oh,
about?
Yes. Everybody did that.
Take your book and a bottle of beer, and two or three of you go out and study in the afternoon, punt a little.
Not so much that. I was doing other things. But weekends and so on, and my punting was always done with girls.
Oh, then you went up to the Charwell to some...
Trout?
To the Trout.
Oh,
yep.
Yeah, sure. Sure. Okay. I never was a great devotee of punting. It was fun to do it occasionally.
I wonder if we could still do it.
Oh, handling the pole.
Yep.
It's taken too great skill, at least to remind me, to get my arms and elbows wet from dripping water all the time. But it was pleasant and beautiful.
You graduated Bachelor of Science?
I took the BSc.
BSc.
You qualify for the BA, but the BA and then the BSc are the years of research. And of course you qualify for your MA by keeping your name on the college books and the passage of time.
In other words, you eat enough dinners, you become an MA.
Yeah. And pay the fee. I didn't become an MA until I went back to England during the war, and then I took my MA. But,
did you have many of the
that's more or less a problem of supporting the university and the college by paying the fee.
Did you have, were you one of those Americans fortunate enough to have your old college chums or anybody you knew in college, the people you worked with on the opposite boards during the war?
No, you see, my generations of Englishmen were 3 years younger than me, 3 to 4 years younger.
And at the time of the war, they wouldn't have been.
And at the time of the war, almost to a man, they were in the armed forces. See, my college roommate Bill Rooks was a captain in the artillery and fought in North Africa and went through the siege of Tobruk and a few other things. Ian Laurie, my friend Ian Laurie, was killed at Dunkirk. Dunkirk, he was with a Scottish regiment.
Same thing happened to me with my friend Dillon, who was in the Rifles. He commanded that last company of Rifles at Calais. Churchill simply said, "You fellows are expendable." And he said, "All right, we are." They didn't come up. I don't want one of them.
Yeah, yeah.
Another one of my friends told me last summer that he developed this liking for sailing, and his family were very, very wealthy. And he said they wouldn't let him come in and get into the Navy the way he wanted to, but at the time of Dunkirk, he's one of those that took his own boat and went over and took people off.
Right. Of course, that evacuation from Dunkirk was fabulous. Fabulous performance. Saved an army and saved a nation in many respects. With everybody pitching in and helping with any kind of boat that could cross the channel.
Right, that's what he did.
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
the man that I associated with, you see, when I was later there in World War II, my war work, were all the older British scientists. And of course, some of my professors. were on those committees. Most, more particularly, the famous organic chemistry professor at Oxford. Oh, let me say his name. Robinson, Sir Robert Robinson, who was one of the four or five best organic chemists in the world, and he was very active in British scientific research during the war. Then my tutor, T.W.J. Taylor, was active and later turned up on the British science mission in Washington during the war, and I used to see him in the later years of the war in Washington. Another Oxford tutor by the name of Wolfenden, who was at Exeter, a friend of mine, a chemist, was also in the scientific liaison work between Britain and this country. And Wolfenden moved to this country and been professor of chemistry at Dartmouth for many years.
I take it when you
and my, my own tutor, H.W. Thompson, was very active in British scientific work. So I used to run into all kinds of Oxford scientific staff. The young men, my friends in college, were all men, of course.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, they were distributed all over the world.
Sure.
With the British Armed Forces, Army, Navy, and Royal Air Force.
I noticed that all of my friends at the Queen's who were pacifists, you see, this is, I was there just before the, remember the declaration will not fight for king or country? That was going very hot. And I just for the fun of it once checked up, and every single one of those boys that I remembered is an ardent pacifist. Never fight. Better read the dead. You know, that kind of.
Yeah.
Every one of them, the Air Corps, Army, Navy, when the chips were down.
Yeah.
They didn't stay out.
Well, I remember when I went to Oxford, I had some friends who were with the Oxford University Air Squadron. And I tried to get in it, to learn to fly. Mm-hmm. And they wouldn't take me, because I was an alien.
Yeah.
My best, one of my best English friends, when I met to rugby football, was Tom Tanner from Bristol. About 6'3", 210, played forward on the Oxford varsity, the top five rugby football player. He was a Quaker from Bristol. Family were leading Quakers in England, wealthy family. And the family were also vegetarian. Tom had never tasted meat. When I went to England in World War II, Tom took law at Oxford and was practicing law in Glasgow. And of course had to appear before his conscientious objection board. And they assigned him to the Friends Ambulance Unit in London. And within 6 months he was running it. He had about 300 young conscientious working for him in east of London, taking care of all the people in the bomb shelters.
Well, boy.
And after dinner, in the spring of 41, Tom would come around to my apartment, his car, and he and I would drive to visit all the bomb shelters in the east end of London, where they took the brunt of the bombing. With Tom, I met literally hundreds of these young English Quakers who were doing such a magnificent job. And Tom was known by everybody in London. Well, after the war, he could have been elected mayor of London if he'd lived. But he, you see, his sister had married Oliver Franks. Barbara Tanner married Sir Oliver Franks. Franks had one of the most meteoric careers in England during the war and after the war.
Absolutely brilliant.
And Oliver and Barbara were, of course, in Washington as British ambassador for a couple of years. Tom was sent by the Quakers to Indian China. They had an ambulance unit in Greece, the Quakers, friends ambulance unit. And they were getting ready to send an ambulance unit into China. And they were having some difficulties getting permission from the Indian government to send the group through, and from the Chinese, the arrangements and so on. So Tom left London on a ship, bound for India, and was going into China to make the arrangements. That ship was sunk off the African coast. It just disappeared. No survivors, nothing. They didn't even know how the ship was lost.
Mine submarine, didn't know.
Didn't know. I think they only found out what happened to it after the war, when they got access to the German naval records. It was probably sunk in stormy conditions. And probably sunk very rapidly, and no survivors. One of the few cases of boats completely disappearing. No survivors.
There's no difficulty.
Nothing. No word even. So Tom had married an American girl. He'd come to Massachusetts to study before he came to Oxford, one of the prep schools near Boston. Family had sent him, so he knew this country and married an American girl after he finished Oxford that he'd met over here. But that was a wonderful family, but he was a conscientious objector and been brought up that way.
And the English didn't fuss about it.
They handled it very well.
I thought they would.
It's now after 10:30 and I have an appointment, and we've had enough talk for today.
We have, and I thank you, and I'll see you next Tuesday about this time.
Okay.
This is the end of the interview with F.L. Hubney on May 18th. Okay.